Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. Tonight, a special edition of our program dedicated entirely to breast cancer research.
It's called precision medicine. It's basically the future of medicine. It's already entered the clinic and we hope to be part of that.
I'll speak with six distinguished cancer researchers who are engaged in several new studies to explore ways to limit cancer cell growth and its spread.
Recently, the lab has been trying to understand how that protein plays a role in the movement of cancer cells.
Plus, we'll hear about an innovative study that's investigating a way to help protect bones during cancer radiation therapy.
These patients can develop fragility either from the tumor itself or from radiation damage to the bone.
A special Healthy Monday Minute and a heartfelt and relevant piece from our Healing Muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we take a special look at some exciting breast cancer research happening in the laboratories at Upstate Medical University. These studies are finding ways to limit the growth and spread of cancer cells. Plus, they will explore more effective ways to protect healthy bone tissue during cancer radiotherapy treatments. We begin our investigation with the WAVE complex. Cancer remains one of the most dreaded diseases of the 20th century and the second leading cause of mortality worldwide. The World Health Organization reports that death from cancer accounted for 7.5 million deaths in 2008, and it could increase to 12 million deaths worldwide by 2030. However, a recently discovered protein family responsible for the way cancer cells reproduce and spread may hold the keys to combating cancer. We'll hear with more on this are Dr. Leszek Kutula, Associate Professor of Urology, Biochemistry, and Molecular Biology, and Dr. Steve Landis, Professor of Pathology and Urology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in. So you've both been given a grant to study this protein family, also known as the WAVE complex. Dr. Landis, tell us, what is this WAVE complex?
The WAVE complex is, simply stated, a group of molecules, a family of molecules that interacts as a team, and based upon which team members are present at any given time in the life of a cell, determines how that cell will behave. It's how it packs, how it travels, how it gets its nutrition, whether it moves, whether it remains stationary. I feel a little bit pretentious because Dr. Kutula has been studying the WAVE complex for over 20 years. He's teaching me now, nearing the end of my first year, as his pupil.
I see. Well, Dr. Kutula, is there something you'd like to add?
Thank you so much for introduction. We actually cloned one of the members of the family, and that's how we got into the research. We initially found a link to prostate cancer, but cancers behave similarly, though there are many different types of cancers. And in breast cancer, apparently this WAVE complex is very important for the invasive type of cancer.
So what it does, so just for my own listeners or for myself to understand, it's a family of proteins or molecules that affect both the way the cancer cells grow and spread. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And particularly cell motility and
how fast they move,
whether they can go to a distant organ. This group of proteins form complexes, and those complexes play a role in the cell motility.
So the migration of the cell, therefore, when we talk about metastases or the movement of a cell to another organ, we're talking about that kind of movement.
That's exactly right. So we think that the WAVE complex could be a target for therapy because in some members of WAVE complex are upregulated, and we think this causes cancer to metastasize. Though if we decrease the level of specific WAVE complex, we may actually stop metastasis or greatly affect it.
So if you can increase or decrease the level of these WAVE proteins, you can actually affect whether cancer will grow and spread.
Exactly.
We've been studying breast cancer for a long time, and it remains, unhappily, such a common disease process, and some of the subsets can be so resistant to treatment and deadly. If we just rest on our advances and congratulate ourselves, we do a disservice. We must continue to look at how these cells do their business, identify potential points of vulnerability so that we can make a difference.
And improve the cure rate,
absolutely.
Basically, in a wide variety of types of cells? Is that the idea?
Yes. With Dr. Catula, we have a wonderful animal model, and we can do all sorts of elegant work, but ultimately we have to translate what we learn in these systems to real living people and make a difference in their health and disease.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Leszek Catula and Steve Landis. We're talking about their work with WAVE proteins in the fight against breast cancer. So very quickly, how will you go about doing this?
Yeah, so we have, as Dr. Landis indicated, we have a beautiful mouse model in which we can modulate the levels of WAVE complex.
You can either increase or decrease them.
Yes. So we use the mouse model that produces invasive breast cancer. And basically then we decrease the levels of WAVE complex, and we can see whether this stops the metastasis. So having the such a great pathologist as Dr. Landis, and also Mira Crandall, who is our also collaborator, who is familiar with the breast cancer specifically model, we can join our expertise to learn more about this metastatic process. And animals have been, especially mice, have been great models for cancer studies. They reproduce fast. We can test many different types of drugs, and we can develop here WAVE complex as a potential target for therapy.
So you are you're going to be using your mouse model,
yes.
Right? And do you see yourselves moving at any point to a human trial? What are the stages of this?
I think the insights we gain from the mouse model, which we have much more control over, which we can study much more systematically, will give us insights that are almost certainly directly applicable. We will then translate those findings into archival human disease material and show proof of concept that what we learn from the mouse model has direct applicability. My main function at Upstate is as a diagnostic pathologist. I have I'm part of a team of very talented people, and I enjoy my diagnostic life, but there is always the reminder with a particularly aggressive cancer that we need better surrogates. We need better data. If you address diagnosis in the same way you always have, you will always get what you've always gotten, and sometimes you realize we can do better.
And this could be a breakthrough,
exactly.
Is what you're saying. So help us understand that. How long, first of all, Dr. Catula, do you think this will take you?
So this study is a step in our understanding of breast cancer. It will lead to determination that this WAVE complex could be used as a target for therapy. Then it opens up many different ways to study this as a target. And we hope that we go for more funding to other places, such as National Institute of Health. And we are very, very grateful to Baldwin's family and Baldwin Foundation.
This is a Baldwin family grant. Yes, Baldwin Foundation grant.
That they support early stages of, because this is very early stages of research, it has high potential, but without this money, we wouldn't be able to do it.
Yes.
So we are very grateful to the family and to the foundation for such a support.
Especially, I think, in the days of the sequester, since the sequester of funding, there's been a real dampening of this kind of research money, and it's wonderful to know that we have local support here, and as you said, you will probably be able to continue with a more federal and national support. What I'm trying to understand, though, is you think that if we can determine that this WAVE family can be a target, the next step would be to determine what drugs could be used to either increase them or decrease their...
Yes, there are many ways of doing that. However, this is proof of concept that this can be targeted genetically. We are targeted genetically in the mouse. There are many different ways of targeting a complex pharmacologically or other ways. So this mouse model could be then used as a model to screen for drugs. We can also use also other methods that are more bench methods without using the animals to screen for drugs that affect that wave complex or wave family.
Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we find ourselves in a situation where we can look at certain members of this family of molecules and know with a high degree of certainty which drugs will work and which will not?
It's going back to that whole idea of kind of customizing the treatment to the nature of the cancer.
Exactly. It's called precision medicine.
Yes, targeted which we,
now
cancer
it's
therapy.
The, it's the, basically the future of medicine. It's already entered the clinic, and we hope to have a be part of that
well,
movement.
Very exciting, and I think it's probably very few people in our central New York area understand or know about the fact that we're doing this kind of cutting-edge research in breast cancer. So I want to thank you both so much. This is very, very fascinating and interesting. How did you both get involved in studying? Dr. Kutula, how did you get involved in studying breast cancer?
Well, I just, since cloning of the protein, I followed the literature, and I understood that by studying prostate cancer, that there are very similar things that happen in prostate cancer and breast cancer. And the mouse model that I created on wave complex could be potentially used to study both cancers.
So the bottom line here is that whatever you find in this particular study might have applicability to other types of cancer as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It can be generalized to other types of cancer.
I've been doing diagnostic pathology for now 35 years, and that's very satisfying. As a 13-year cancer survivor myself, the area of malignancies and how to diagnose them and treat them is particularly important.
Well, once again, I can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing this important work. And maybe you'll come back when you're done with at least some stage with some good news. We'd love to have you back and find out more information.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
My guests have been Dr. Leszek Kutula, Associate Professor of Urology and Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, and Dr. Steve Landis, Professor of Pathology and Urology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Cancer cell growth and its spread, or metastasis, are the two main factors which lead to cancer's deadly effects. Here with more on their quest for a cancer-fighting chemical and how they will determine its effectiveness in combating cancer are Dr. Christopher Turner, Distinguished Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology, and Dr. Nicholas Deacon, Research Assistant Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology, both at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So you've all both been given a grant to study to try to limit the growth of cancer cells and their spread. Dr. Turner, tell us about it.
Okay, so I've actually been interested in how cells move for about 20 years. And way back in 1990, I discovered this protein paxillin that was playing an important role in cell movement. More recently, the lab has been trying to understand how that protein plays a role in the movement of cancer cells away from the primary tumor and how it gets into the bloodstream and then colonizes distant organs, metastases. We think it's important to try to understand how paxillin is playing a role in this, because if we can develop ways in which we can limit paxillin's function, we may be able to block the process of metastasis.
And you have already done some work in that direction, or is this the beginning?
Yes, we've done some initial studies using a mouse model to show that when we inhibit paxillin's expression, we block the movement of cancer cells to the lungs. Our more recent work has actually focused on a new mechanism in which paxillin may be doing this. And that is through its regulation of microtubules, the cytoskeleton within the cells. A lot of drugs that are targeted against breast cancer tumors actually target the microtubule cytoskeleton. And we found that the level of expression of paxillin in tumor cells may actually influence the microtubule cytoskeleton, and therefore may influence how those drugs actually work in individual patients.
So bottom line, Dr. Deacon, it's you're attempting to once again customize by your ability to control the level of paxillin, if you find that it is controllable and it can then affect whether a cell will change or spread. If you can then perhaps target some treatments to that.
Sure. I mean, there's multiple facets of the study. I mean, one gold standard at the moment in breast cancer treatment is personalized treatment. You know, each patient is different, and they have different types of things going on in their tumor. And the gold standard is if we can figure out exactly what's going on, then we can develop specific treatment regimes for that particular patient, which can be most effective. And what we're hoping is that we can test for the amount of Paxil, the amount of these different proteins in these tumors and in these metastases, and see whether if we can eliminate the use of like the wrong kind of drug, or maybe taper down a type of drug so that there's less side effects. So, you know, by hopefully finding out how much protein there is, we can figure out how much treatment we need to add or what direction the treatment needs to go in.
So you're really kind of tailoring or customizing the treatment. It's that targeted cancer therapy idea.
Absolutely. Every cancer has a molecular signature, and that's where a lot of the physicians are targeting their analysis these days. What we found is that the presence of Paxilin affects the stability of the microtubules, and a lot of anti-cancer drugs target those microtubule networks, but they have terribly toxic side effects. So if, it, for instance, we find by screening a tumor that the level of Paxilin is low, we may be able to use the same therapy but at a lower dose to have the same impact on the tumor growth and metastasis. So that has two benefits. One is that the tumor is contained, and also the patient suffers less with regards to the toxic side effects.
So the microtubules exist in all cells, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That is
It's
correct.
Part of the skeleton of every cell. But how about Paxilin? Is that in all of our cells, or is it just in a tumor cell?
Yes, it's actually in all of our cells at different levels. In the case of cancers, it may be upregulated or downregulated, and that is true of just about every protein that is playing a role in cancers. It's very rare for us to just see expression of a particular protein just in cancer cells. So targeting these proteins is actually very difficult, because you obviously potentially target
harm
healthy
cells
as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen, here with Basic Science breast cancer researchers, Dr. Christopher Turner and Dr. Nicholas Deacon. We're talking about their new study that will help to determine if a particular protein, Paxilin, will help in the fight against breast cancer. So how exactly will you go about doing this?
Yeah, so basically what we're going to start with doing is with isolated cell studies. So we're going to take cells that we can grow in a culture dish and basically figure out if we can manipulate the levels of this protein, do we affect the effectiveness of the drug? In other words, do the cells become more susceptible to dying because of this drug?
And so you're literally going to be testing different chemotherapy
exactly,
drugs.
In a number of breast cancer cell lines, absolutely, and see whether one is more effective than another.
Yeah, and the drugs that we're targeting are ones that are routinely used in the clinic now. So we're not developing new drugs per se, we're just seeing how the level of Paxilin in particular cancer cells affect the responsiveness of those cells to these drugs.
And is there a hope as well that out of this type of research, new drugs would evolve?
I think so. I mean, if we can understand the mechanism by which Paxilin is doing what it's doing to promote these cells to invade away from this primary tumor, then we may be able to develop drugs that specifically isolate that one pathway in a cancer cell to prevent the spread of the disease. And that's key because, you know, nationally in the US, about 40,000 women die from breast cancer each year. And 95% of those are linked with the metastasis. So it's not the tumor in the breast that really is the problem. It's the ability of the cells to move away from there and cause secondary problems. So if we can detect them early, and if we can then treat them with a drug or know what drug to go with to stop their spread, then that's going to greatly influence the survival of these patients and, you know, minimize side effects, help with the long-term survival, reduce the spread. I mean, these are all good things that hopefully we're going to get out of it.
So you've been given this a local grant from the Baldwin Foundation. It also strikes me this kind of research should also be a candidate for national support as well, because it sounds like some very important opportunities here.
Fortunately, we also have a five-year grant from the NIH.
You do as well.
To study the relative roles of Paxillin and another protein that has a similar function called HIC-5. So we have an ongoing study that is really looking at the mechanisms that we've been talking about today. The Baldwin grant is going to give us this opportunity to extend that study into looking at how it may impact the efficacy of these already existing anti-cancer drugs. So it's a nice complement to the government study that we already are funded for.
So in a realistic time frame, what do you expect, or how do you look toward the future in terms of when you will find some answers with regard to this piece of the study? And how will it then translate? I mean, can it translate within the next 5 years into the way we treat cancer?
I think if we can demonstrate a causal relationship, as we've been talking about, between the level of Paxillin and how these cancer cells respond to the drugs that are already in the clinic, then potentially it could progress very quickly, because all we would have to do would be include Paxillin as a marker in these screens that are done of tumor samples currently.
So
it wouldn't require a new drug to go through clinical trials and become on the market,
testing,
which takes 10 to 15 years. Potentially, if a clinician knows that the level of Paxillin is low in a particular tumor, they could immediately modify the level of drug that they are giving those individuals.
And thereby, they would still the effectiveness of the drug would remain strong, but you would avoid all of those very negative side effects.
Right. And obviously, we're not clinicians, but I think there's a number of clinicians at Upstate that are very interested and work aggressively to treat patients with breast cancer at Upstate. So my hope is moving forward that in the next year or so we can start collaborating with those clinicians and hopefully perhaps get some tumor samples and evaluate new tissue and see whether we get the same effects. And those sorts of studies would obviously have to be done in our lab before we start asking patients to change
their
treatment
regimens,
etc.
Right. But that would be the next...
That would be the next step that I would hope we would be able to move forward with, hopefully within, a year or two after we've finished the Baldwin study.
My guests have been Dr. Christopher Turner, Distinguished Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology, and Dr. Nicholas Deakin, Research Assistant Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much. We wish you the best of luck in your endeavors. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, how aromatase inhibitors can help fight cancer. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Radiation therapy is a common cancer treatment for breast cancer, which uses radiation to destroy cancer cells, usually following surgery. However, it is not without risk. We'll hear with more on this, and a new study to reduce some of that risk is Dr. Megan Ost, Assistant Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Ost.
Thanks.
So radiation therapy is an important treatment option for patients with breast cancer. Can you just tell us about that?
Right. So radiation therapy uses very high energy x-rays, higher than what you usually get at a doctor's office for, imaging a broken arm or something. And he uses that with the goal of destroying the cancerous cells, which, are more susceptible to damage than normal tissues. So the idea is that radiation therapy can kill off some or all of the tumor, and then parts of it can be removed.
And then surgery. I'm noticing that it's often done when they try to conserve the breast, let's say if there's a small area they have to take, or if even after a mastectomy, they may do it. So it's usually done in combination with some kind of surgical
Right. It's not usually a standalone treatment, and it's actually used a lot for pain management for breast cancer metastases to the bone too, where it's very effective there too.
I also read that it was also being used with brain, if there have been metastases to the brain as well. So obviously it's a very important modality and something that has a lot of positives to it. But and how effective is it?
It can be very effective. It depends on the, you know, size of the tumor, how widely spread it is, you know, whether or not there's been surgical resection of the tumor as well. So it's really patient and site dependent, but it can be very effective for a lot of clinical applications.
Yeah, some of the stats that I looked upon said that they actually did a review that said that radiotherapy really lowered the risk of cancer coming back, either in that remaining breast tissue or even in the nearby lymph nodes. So it seems like it really has a very, very powerful impact, but it's not without risk.
Right.
Tell us about that.
I'm in the orthopedic surgery department, so most of our work focuses on orthopedic damage, which with breast cancer patients, you know, one of the unfortunately more common ways to detect it is that you'll see metastases or lesions on the bone resulting from, you know, distribution of the breast cancer cells there. So one of the problems is that these patients can develop fragility either from the tumor itself or from radiation damage to the bone.
So let's back up a second. When you use the term fragility, help us understand what you mean.
How fragile the bone is, how, you know, it's mechanical strength. So it can become more brittle and more susceptible to just breaking, you know, due to just general activities of daily living. So normally you're walking around and you don't break a leg unless you're involved in some kind of high energy collision, like a car accident or something. But with these patients, one thing that we see clinically is that they have radiation therapy and, you know, survive and get better. And then years later, they'll be getting out of a chair and their leg fractures.
Really? So, but you pointed out that it's not only, that sometimes it can be as a result of the actual cancer that they've sustained, that metastasized to the bone.
Right.
But in addition or secondarily, the radiation alone damages the bone.
So, yeah, so there can be damage from a lesion to the bone, or there can be damage to the bone seas because you receive radiation treatment to a nearby soft tissue. So radiation treatment for breast cancer, frequently the ribs will also be in the, you know, within the field of radiation. So patients will see, you know, a rib fracture down the road, even though there may not have actually been any cancerous cells in the rib.
It takes some time when you say late onset, so it's not usually immediately after the treatment.
It can be 1 to 5 years down the road, and there's no really good way to predict that clinically. We don't really have a good tool for that. So,
if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with orthopedist Dr. Megan Osten. We're talking about radiotherapy-induced bone damage after breast cancer radiation treatments. So you've just been given a grant to study this whole problem. Tell us about it.
Right. So we received some funding from the Carolyn Baldwin Breast Cancer Research Foundation. And we've had the kind of this ongoing project where I've been working with Dr. Timothy Dameron, and we use a mouse model of radiation damage to bone so that we can look at, you know, the effects in a living system that we couldn't necessarily study in people. So this grant in particular is looking at damage to the bone cells and their progenitors, or different types of stem cells that happen following radiation therapy. And
so I'm going to stop you there when you say the progenitor cells. These are the cells that give rise to healthy bone cells?
Right, right. So you hear the term stem cell thrown around all over the place today. So you have all kinds of different stem cells in your body.
Which are cells that can be multi-purposed?
Right. So stem cells are sort of like, you know, they're just sort of a source that reproduce themselves and renew all different types of cells. So they haven't committed to what they want to be yet.
Right. So they're uncommitted cells.
They're uncommitted. Right. So they're the high school seniors that haven't picked their college major yet.
Yes,
right?
Got it.
So they can go out and then, you know, pick a major later,
right,
depending on what's needed,
right,
you know, whatever the job market is. So, you know, we've looked at some of the specific effects on the bone cells that are alive at the time of radiation, and we know some of them die and some of them live, and this contributes to, you know, the fracture risk. But what we've noticed is some of the cells that die off never get replenished, and it seems to be specific to the type of cell. And so we're interested in, you know, when are they dying, how are they dying, and why aren't these stem cells being renewed, and how can we preserve them so that you'd have normal bone function and health? So your bone turns over your whole life. It's constantly renewing. You don't have the same skeleton as you did 7 years ago. So
the concept here really is, if you understood the mechanisms by which they die and or do renew or survive, then you could develop a methodology for protecting those during a radiation procedure. Is that the idea?
Right. Yeah, that's kind of the idea. So,
and what kinds of protection are we talking about? I mean, obviously, in our standard life today, if you're going to get a radiation or an X-ray, the X-ray tech wears a lead shield, something of that nature, or if dental X-rays or what have you. Are you thinking those kinds of things, or are you thinking something more chemical?
Right. We're thinking something more chemical or biological. So, you know, as is, when a patient goes in for radiation therapy, they really try and focus the X-ray beam on
targeted.
It's very targeted, right, to prevent that kind of damage. So we've sort of done almost as much as we can in that way. But, you know, you can't necessarily stop an X-ray from penetrating beyond a certain depth of tissue all the time. So,
right.
So we're looking at, you know, ways to scavenge free radicals. Like, you hear a lot about antioxidants, you know, and they're good for your diet, or maybe not so great for your diet, depending on who you're talking to. But, you know, we're looking at things like that that can prevent damage specifically to these cells. That would be something along the lines of, like, you know, an injection that you could receive half an hour before you go into radiotherapy, that kind of thing, to prevent that kind of damage. So more chemical or biological measures.
So exactly how will you be going about this? I mean, just give us a thumbnail overview.
So we have this pretty well-established mouse model. So we actually use these mice, and we will irradiate only one of their legs. And then we look at that bone over time and look at changes in it. So mice, just like humans, have stem cells in their bone. And there's several distinct populations of stem cells. So what we'll do is we'll take our mice and we'll irradiate them, and we'll collect those cells at different time points and look at the health of those cells. Are they able to renew themselves? Are they able to form, you know, healthy bone and fat and cartilage cells like they should be able to? So we look at, you know, that kind of ability to differentiate and see how that changes with time. And then we're going to try a couple different interventions. One's a radioprotectant that's sort of been used experimentally off and on for several decades, but isn't really well known because there's some toxicity concerns, but, you know, those could be addressed with targeted drug delivery. But so we're going to look at a couple different interventions. And then one of the options, too, is to look at whether or not you could donate some stem cells from another healthy mouse to a mouse that had irradiation, and see if those would recover the function.
So almost like a stem cell transplant following radiation.
Right. Very similar to that.
Yeah. They really are doing a lot of research, as you said earlier, in many, many areas in medicine, with the notion that these uncommitted cells could really kind of rally to the cause, right, if placed where they need to be at a particular point in time.
Right. And that's one thing we've noticed in our previous work, too, is that it's really site-specific. So if we only do radiotherapy on one of the mouse's legs, the other leg is still healthy, and those cells are healthy, but somehow they don't get over to the unhealthy leg. So, you know, in theory, if it worked, you could actually take patients from a healthy, or cells from a healthy side of the patient, and put it into the patient's own unhealthy side and recover it.
How long will it take you, in the very few seconds we have left, how long do you think your study will last?
This will probably take us about 2 years to fully investigate that.
I hope you'll come back and tell us what you find. It's fascinating, and I wish you all the best luck with it. It's very, very exciting work. My guest has been Dr. Megan Ost. She's assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at Upstate Medical University and doing research into preserving bone after radiotherapy. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, how some new efforts may find a way to prevent bone damage during cancer radiotherapy. Welcome back to HealthLink On Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for this week. Do the best for your breasts. Breast cancer is the second most common type of cancer diagnosed in American women. And although it's more rare, men can develop breast cancer too. Fortunately, eating a healthy and balanced diet, especially high in fruits and vegetables, exercising regularly, maintaining a healthy weight, not smoking, and limiting alcohol consumption may all lower your risk for developing breast cancer. This week, evaluate your current breast cancer prevention practices and check to see when your next screening should be. If you're between the ages of 50 and 74, you should have a mammogram once every 2 years. If outside of this age range, talk to your physician about your risk factors and when you should get screened for breast cancer. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink On Air. Cancer has always been with us. We have evidence of its existence as far back as biblical times, with descriptions of breast tumors found written on Egyptian papyrus dating back to 1600 BC. But recent new approaches to chemotherapy have gone beyond the old cell-kill paradigm of attempting to kill all rapidly growing cells in the body, and it's moved toward the development and deployment of highly targeted, non-toxic chemical therapies based on genetic science. Well, joining me to help understand more about this approach and his own research is Dr. Debashis Ghosh. He's professor of pharmacology at Upstate Medical University and a world-renowned research scientist with the Upstate Cancer Research Institute. Welcome, Dr. Ghosh. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us more about cancer chemotherapy and how it's changed.
So there are molecules in the body which are the, sometimes you can call them bad guys. Those are the molecules that cause or as perceived to cause problems.
You say molecules.
Molecules. And those molecules are singled out. And what we call as molecular intervention, those are those agents or drugs that actually bind or target those molecules.
So what you're saying is one time we saw all, we were killing all rapidly growing cells.
That's right.
Almost like a big shotgun approach.
That's right.
Anything, any target that was moving fast.
That's right.
And now we have an understanding of the molecular structure of some of these
Absolutely.
Cancers.
So, and we target specifically with agents to specifically bind and inactivate or overactivate those molecules.
So they actually do it, they kill just the molecule.
It's exactly like targeted missiles, you know. So that's a good analogy for these drugs. So these drugs are used to either immobilize or inactivate, or sometimes, if loss of function is the problem, overactivate these molecules. So that the cause, the basic molecular basis for cancer can be remedied.
Wow.
So that is the so-called, targeted cancer therapy.
So how does this fit into, you've been doing very specific work on aromatase, which is an inhibitor,
That's
correct?
Right. Aromatase is the enzyme or the molecule that makes estrogen.
In
human body. So without aromatase, there is no estrogen. And estrogen is essential for the development and growth of human beings.
And that's male and female.
Male and female. But it becomes more important for reproduction and maintenance of life for female. So it is the most well-known and most important female steroid hormone, also known as the sex steroids. So, but sometimes estrogen excess is a problem.
So you're saying since aromatase is responsible for controlling the levels of estrogen in the body,
exactly.
Sometimes you're saying There's too much estrogen.
That's right. It's too much estrogen and locally produced in the tumors, in the breast tumors.
So when breast cancer occurs,
that's right.
It's the tumor is creating more estrogen.
That's exactly right. And as we know, 70 to 80% of all postmenopausal breast cancers are estrogen dependent, are triggered and proliferated by estrogen.
This is postmenopausal?
Particularly in postmenopausal women, because their estrogens are being produced not in endocrine organs, but locally, like in the breast, you know, breast fat cells. So the aromatase inhibitors actually are used to inhibit the production of estrogen.
Okay, so you did, I guess your lab determined the three-dimensional structure of aromatase. And developed a way of inhibiting it.
That's right. So we, for the first time, people got to see how aromatase works and how estrogen is being produced. Now, the idea is to utilize this knowledge to make better inhibitors of aromatase so that it will have very few, if any, side effects.
So by slowing down or eliminating the aromatase, inhibiting the aromatase, you thereby reduce the amount of estrogen and the tumors shrink?
That's exactly right. And turns out the aromatase inhibitors are the most prolific anti-breast cancer drugs for postmenopausal hormone-dependent breast cancer.
Wow. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Debashis Ghosh, and we're talking about targeted cancer therapy and how the aromatase inhibitors can basically treat breast cancer. So has this been put from, I know you're doing, this is all being done in a laboratory, but have you gone from bench to bedside? Is this being tested currently?
That's exactly what we are in the process of doing at the moment. But we have actually shown that some of these compounds that are made with that kind of detailed understanding of aromatase actually work better even in the cells, in the breast cancer cells that have been isolated from tumor. And we use these compounds to test against the most well-known drugs. And some of our compounds have performed better, much better than the current drug, which is known as aromycin or exemestane, which is used today against breast cancer. So we have gone up to the cell, and this is all published now. But next step is to take them to animal model, and that's exactly what we are doing. And we just got the Carol Baldwin Award for doing exactly that, to test these drugs in animal models.
So let me just rephrase. So right now, you've been working on a cellular level. You've been looking at cancer cells.
That's right.
And you found that these aromatase inhibitors can literally kill,
yes,
stop the production of the cell.
Yeah, and they have what is known as anti-proliferative activity.
So it doesn't...
Doesn't proliferate, it doesn't grow as fast as in cancer cell.
And compared to the current therapies that are out there, drugs that are being currently used, this may be actually more effective.
This is almost an order of magnitude better than the current drug that is being used against breast cancer.
So that's a revolutionary potential there.
Well, but it is only in the lab level.
Right.
You know?
So the next step is to animal model.
That's right.
And then at some point, human trial?
Absolutely. That's the goal. That's why we are doing research what we are doing today.
So the animal model, you have some funding now to go proceed into the animal models.
That's exactly right.
How do you project how long this might take till you actually have a drug that could be brought to market?
Well, when I first did the structure of aromatase, and I was asked this question, I said 5 years. So it's almost 5 years we have gone this far, and I would say in another 5 years' time, I mean, there's a good chance that we will have some of these compounds in a phase one trial. And that's my goal.
Wow. Wow, that's really amazing. So if in effect it's a more it's less harmful, less side effects, and more effective treatment for breast cancer.
Right.
You really have broken the code, so
that's
to speak,
right.
for
we
breast cancer.
We can get away with applying, with taking much smaller amounts of these drugs than the current drugs. You know, that's where high potency comes into play. And secondly, specificity and selectivity. You know, if that, you know, if these compounds leave everything else alone and works against only aromatase in when it's, you know, in the tissues that produces, in the tissues that produce these tumors, then our both purposes are served.
I think it's remarkable. You must be extremely excited about the possibility here.
And thanks to all the funding that we are getting for our work.
Well, I mean, I hope you'll come back at some point and share with us how your work is proceeding, because this really is absolutely revolutionary and cutting edge. And it basically suggests that you can save many, many more lives this way as well.
Let's hope that we can do it. That's clearly the goal. That keeps me awake at night.
Well, I can only thank you so much for coming in and sharing this with us. My guest has been Dr. Debashis Ghosh. He's a professor of pharmacology at Upstate Medical University. He's a world-renowned research scientist, as you can see, with the Upstate Cancer Research Institute. Once again, thanks so very much for coming in. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope you'll come back and keep us abreast, yes. No pun intended, of what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Poet Bonnie St. Andrews wrote a meditative poem about breast cancer when two of her friends were diagnosed with the disease. In this poem, she thinks about how we talk about breasts, how we think about them pre-diagnosis and then post-diagnosis, and how very brave women are. Here then is Your Breast, a Unicorn. 1. Uncut and unsewn, my breasts nuzzle yellow silk, secure as two fawns nestled in Debussy's dream, sun-dappled and safe, finding solace singly and together. My heart beats staccato under slumbering glands of these breasts, and I think about the milk of human kindness and my friend who, unaware, suckled an abomination which curled inside her softness and betrayed her. Like Cleopatra's asp awakening on compassion's mound, on passion's curve, at consolation's center, one aberrant cell metastasized, stirring from slumber, to pierce with death that tender sweetness it had dreamt upon. 2. She hates that phrase, lost a breast, with its insinuation of carelessness. It's not as if the three of us went off to market, she says, my left breast, my right breast, and I, and one zipped off to ice cream while the other darted to bottled dressings, and me just meandering besides vegetables, stacked and clotted like a painter's palette, with apricot, celeriac, eggplant, muscadine. It's not as if I realized suddenly one of my breasts had gone missing and charged the courtesy counter, breathless on the PA system, announcing, I'm waiting on aisle 9 for my right breast, my recalcitrant child, who has spent her full, fragile, throbbing life with me. So please return, please, and help me push the cart piled high with treats for her, my other darling, my rose-tipped girl, my comfort. 3. Breasts make money, cut or uncut. We speak of capital B breasts as if they were priceless organisms to be mined or culled or caught in the teeth, and so they are. The breast is a bronze pendant, a cocoa fruit lopped from its emerald vine. Breast is an apricot moon pinned to the vineyard of night, a pool mirroring the love-sustaining needs of women and men, women and women, mothers and sucklings. Breast, tumescent and detumescent as any male part, is mystical and defiled, swollen and confined, life-giving and powerful as Africa's Nile. The breast reigns, queen of solace, empress of Amazons, priestess of pleasure. We all worship the breast, ripening or withered, first pillow, first nation, first food. 4. Your breast is gone, medically incinerated before we could place it among stars. Lost as the unicorn, that ancient sigil of innocence, your legendary breast is extinct and wandering in fields of praise. Like the unicorns, let your struggles be woven into tapestries and hung in halls of queens and heroes. Let your face be fashioned of herbs and flowers. Let your courage be emblazoned in golden thread, so light-yielding, so steadfast, that fragile sister ships may, by your radiance, glide unperturbed past shoals and reefs of fear and anguish which lay siege on every heart. By your burning, may ships heavy laden, carved with busts of mermaids and deities who tame wild seas, deliver safely their cargo of women, brave and beautiful as you.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore epilepsy in the elderly and inflammatory bowel disease syndrome in children. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. Or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.